were going like
okay. Let's go back for a second to our last result here. This is again how you can check if a task can complete before the deadline with the method of the demand bound function. Here I'm also introducing one additional concept or variation to the analysis, and this is how you should modify the formula for computing the worst case response time when tasks are periodic with release jitter. Meaning, if tasks are not activated according to an exact periodic time base, but they may be delayed up to j units of time from each activation, each periodic event. Okay? So if the activation time base is not periodic, but each activation event can be delayed up to j units of time, this is the formula you should use. Okay? And again, the left-hand side simply shows you what is the concept. The green line here is the demand bound for task one. So you see when there is release jitter, actually the worst case corresponds to the case in which the first instance of the task is released with maximum jitter. So the first one is released here after J, in this case J1 for the first task time units. Those with the dots here are the periodic events. And all the others come as soon as possible. Okay? So you have the first pair that has minimum separation, and then all the other events become periodic at this point, from this point on. Okay? This is the worst case load or interference that we can get from task one on the lower priority tasks. And this is accounted for with that term here inside the series. So now if you have the green function, which is the demand bound for task one, and the blue or purple one that is the demand bound for task two, and then you add them up, the black line here is the demand bound function for tasks one and two. So if you have now one task, which we can imagine is task three, at the priority level immediately below task two, its response time is given by the point where this line here, which is y equals t, matches the demand bound function, which is here. Okay? So that's the other method for computing the worst case response time. Now let's move to EDF. I said the other time this is one of the topics we're going to discuss today very shortly. So static priority, you cannot do better than rate monotonic or deadline monotonic according to where the deadlines are. If deadlines are longer than the period, we have seen the other day, there is another method for finding the optimal priority assignment. Okay? In general, you're not guaranteed to achieve 100% utilization unless the periods are harmonic. If all the periods in your task set are harmonic, then you are guaranteed up to 100% utilization. Okay, this is an additional result that you can use. So let's see a possible scenario here, again very similar to the one that I presented the other day with two tasks with period 2 and 3, and you see here that this task in this case misses its deadline, and this is because of preemption from task A. However, this is not necessarily the best you can do. Suppose now you schedule according to another method, which is called, again, earliest deadline first. And according to this method, each time you activate a task instance, you give to that task instance a priority which is inversely proportional with respect to its deadline. Okay? So the closest is the deadline, the highest is the priority. In this way, this task instance here that has this deadline will get higher priority than this one that has the deadline down here. So in this case, this same task set that is not schedulable with rate monotonic will become schedulable. And of course, not only this, but you can increase utilization up until 100%. Okay? So clearly, since you can get up to 100%, EDF is optimal. Of course, 100% when deadlines are equal to periods. Okay? Deadlines are less than periods, EDF is still optimal, although you don't have a guarantee of 100% utilization. Now, here's the issue. If you try to look for a commercial implementation of EDF, you won't find, unless you find some kernel which is borderline between research and commercial. And the reasons that you find are something like this. The implementations of earliest deadline are inefficient or carry too much overhead, and so they are not feasible in typical embedded real-time systems where operating system overhead should be the least as possible. Or the other one, that EDF cannot be controlled in overload conditions, because typically in overload what you can get using EDF is a domino effect. And we will shortly analyze both of them. Well, problem with implementation. Absolute deadline, we said priorities are assigned correspondingly to the deadline. The problem is that absolute deadlines are ever increasing. And they change for each new task instance, so the priority needs to be updated every time you activate a task. So every time you activate a task, you need to update the priority. So this is a small additional overhead at activation time. You need to update the priority field in the task descriptor. But this doesn't look too bad. However, absolute deadlines are also always increasing, while the field that we have for representing the task priority is typically limited in size. Say, for example, you have 16 bits for expressing the priority. So how can you encode deadlines that are ever increasing with only a finite priority field inside the task description? And the other one is that they cannot be computed a priori. There are infinitely many absolute deadlines. Okay? So again, you have a problem of finding some type of quantization or mapping between the absolute deadline value and, say, for example, the 16-bit value that you have available inside the task descriptor for encoding the deadline, the priority. Let's see how the first problem. Well, then we have another problem, and this is probably the most important one. Now, the problem here is that inside the operating system there are several queues where task descriptors are kept, and what is a task descriptor depends on the operating system. We have seen TinyOS. A task descriptor may simply be the pointer to a function. Okay? It may be a pointer to a data structure, it may be typically is an index into a table, into one array that contains the task descriptors, information about the tasks. Okay? So let's see what is the impact on the queues. Now what are the queues that you have inside an operating system? Any suggestions? Ready queue is the first one, it's probably the most important. Okay? So we cannot. Ready queue, let's put ourselves in the easiest scenario of a single core system or single processor system. So you can have many tasks that are active and ready for running at any time, and you can only pick one to be executed. Where do you put all the others? You put them into a queue, which is called ready queue. Now, in a system that is scheduled by priority, every time you need to pick the new task for execution, you need to pick it from this queue and it makes sense to have this queue sorted by priority. Now, almost all systems are scheduled by priority these days, okay? Now, you also get additional queues in an operating system. Which other ones, for example? Anytime you have a set of tasks that are waiting for something, you need a queue, basically, okay? So if you have a set of tasks that are waiting for a synchronization event, you have a set of tasks that are waiting for a resource to be freed, for a lock to be released, you have a queue. So typically to each semaphore, you associate a queue, right? We'll see that there are methods for collapsing on semaphore queues here. This can also possibly be very interesting. However, we got queues everywhere, okay, where we store these task descriptors, and these queues are kept sorted by priority. Now, let's see what are the typical implementations in operating systems for the ready queue, okay? So typically in operating systems, you have a limited number of priorities. In OSEC operating systems for the automotive, you can have as little as 8 priority levels. In commercial operating systems like Windows or Linux, you can have more, but typically in the range of say 32 priority levels, something like that. Okay? In real-time operating systems, you can have a little bit more, but it's very difficult to go beyond an 8-bit encoding, which means 256 priority levels. So what is the typical implementation of the ready queue in an operating system? Well, the problem is that we want the operations that are working on this queue to be as efficient as possible, right? Because these are operations that are basically needed every time you perform a counter switch. So anytime you take the CPU, anytime, for example, you perform preemption, you take away a task from the CPU and you put it back into the ready queue, and then you get the highest priority task from the ready queue and you put it into the execution on the processor, okay? So we want these operations to be as fast as possible. So if we have the implementation of the queue as a simple linked list, you see here, typically, extraction is constant time. I'm quite sure you are familiar with this notation, right? So extraction is typically constant time because the queue is kept sorted at any time, right? So you typically have the highest priority task here on top. The problem is when you have to insert back some task into the queue, you need to scan the queue until you find the right position. Okay, so extraction is constant time and insertion is variable time, and it depends on how many tasks you have in this queue. So this is typically not nice. We would like to have everything constant time and fast. Okay. Pardon? Yeah, you can make it, well, you can make it faster than linear time using some other methods like binary sorting. You can make log n type of complexity, right?
But actually, for the point you're making that you always want constant time?
Yes. We would like to have constant time. And indeed, I don't have it here, I have it in some slides, some previous slides, where when you look at some advertisement, like when Linux went from kernel 2.4 to 2.6, one of the changes that was advertised is that now scheduling was constant time, meaning exactly this thing here, okay? So when they went from 2.4 to 2.6, the scheduler was changed, data structures were changed, and scheduling became constant time. What does it mean? Okay, this is another typical implementation, typical of general purpose systems. So in general purpose systems, the first step is that now you don't have a single queue. You have an array of queues with one entry for each priority level. And inside each queue, you keep all the tasks that have the same priority, and those are managed FIFO. So now, insertion into this data structure becomes constant time. Because when you insert, given the priority of the task that you are adding to the queue, you know what is the entry in the array that you should select. And since each one of those queues are FIFO, if you have a double linked list, you add the new task at the bottom. And the bottom can be accessed directly through a pointer or an index, if it's an array-based implementation. Okay? So this means that now insertion is constant time. Extraction, however, requires us to find what is the first entry in this array that is not empty. So now in the worst case, we need to scan this array until we find the first entry which has a task. So in the worst case, this is linear time in the number of priority levels this time. Okay? Now, it is linear time in the number of priority levels, but on the average, this works pretty well. Because as soon as you keep filling this, you are much more likely to find something from the start, at the top of this array. Okay? While in the other case, in the case of a simple linked list, it's actually the other way around. The more you put descriptors into the queue, the worse is the performance. Here it's the opposite. The more you put descriptors into this data structure, the better is the average response time, the average extraction time. So, and we're getting very close to what is the actual, and you see here, these are the average extraction times, and these are the measured insertion times for a data structure like this. Now, okay, how do we get to constant time? We can get to constant time if we use bitmaps to represent the state of each queue. So we said we have an array of queues, one entry for each priority level. Each entry basically is a double linked list, okay, of task descriptors. You need to find the first entry that is non-empty. So now you assign a bitmap that defines, describes what is the state of these entries here. So whenever it is, there is at least one task descriptor, you put one. And if it's empty, you put zero. Okay? So, now it is something like this, right? So now when you need to extract a task, it becomes finding the first bit at one into this bitmask. And of course, updating these bits, it can be done in constant time. If you extract the last task from here, you actually make an end with a mask with a zero here, and you zero the corresponding bit. And whenever you add the task, you make an OR with a bitmask with a 1 here, so you set up the corresponding bit. Okay? So management of this data bit structure, this bitmask, can be done in constant time. Now, the problem is, if you need to find what is the highest rank bit that is set in this mask, it's typically not necessarily constant time. You may need to do bit shifting on some architectures, right? Plus, you got the additional problem that if you have 8 entries or 32 entries, this can be a single register, can fit within a single register. If you have 16 bits for representing priorities, as we are assuming, for example, for EDF, we will need 65,000 entries here, and the bitmask with 65,000 bits, which is unrealistic. Okay, so this is the reason why if you have long fields for encoding priorities, it is almost impossible, or right away impossible, to use a data structure like this. Okay? So let's make a first a very simple case in which we have, say for example, only 8 priority levels, and then we will see the case in which we have more, for example, like 64 or 256. So first case, 8 priority levels, the only problem we have now is to find the highest rank bit set here. So you can do shifting of this mask, and it's still not constant time, because you don't know how many shifts you need until you find a bit at 1. However, there are two ways in which this problem can be fixed. One way is if you get help from your controller or microprocessor with an instruction like this. So this is from the ARM9. You get a hardware level instruction that gives you right away what is the rank of the highest bit set. Like this one, count leading zeros. So you feed the bit mask here into a register, you call this operation, and it will give you the index of the first bit that is at 1. Okay? Which is equivalent to the number of leading zeros you get in your mask. So now you got constant time access. The other case in which you can get constant time access is, let's say we have a bit mask. Let's make 8 bits. Now let's say we have a pattern, whatever, like this, for example. I want to get the position of the highest bit set here. So if this is the binary encoding of the number n, how can we get this index I, given n? Here, for example, we got this is the encoding of 16 plus 4, 21. How can we get this number here, the rank of this bit, which is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4?
Just an integer part of log 2.
Pardon?
You just log 2 and take an integer part and get your CPU.
Exactly. However, we don't have a function like this that is available as a low-level instruction. But whenever we have a function for which we don't have a low-level instruction and we want an implementation that is fast, constant time, what is that we do? Function can be represented or implemented as a lookup table, okay? So basically get a lookup table for this. Well, shifts, how many shifts you need. And again, because you need to set up a cycle and shift. If you get a lookup table, it's a single instruction. Just indexing. And indeed, I don't know if it's true anymore, but in some version of VxWorks, which is a commercial real-time operating system that was sold, it's still being sold actually, from Wind River, you found a statement like, extraction of the tasks from the ready queue is implemented in linear time, however, if you're willing to pay 65K of additional RAM memory, they didn't say, but because of the lookup table, then extraction is constant time. So you had this as an option. Okay. So this is how things are actually implemented inside real-time operating systems in such a way that you have fast context switch times, and you have a ready queue that can be accessed for insertions and extractions in constant time. Okay. Now, one more thing. What if the priority levels are 256? You don't get a register that can hold 256 bits, right? So what is the solution? It's again typical solution you find in the operating systems in many cases when you have virtual tables or things like this. When you have many entries, you build a hierarchical structure. So you have a first level bit mask, for example, of 16 bits, and you have 16 second level bit masks, again 16 bits each, so in the end you have 256 entries, and the bit mask of first level is only going to say if inside the corresponding second level mask there is at least one bit that is set to 1. Okay? And so now the step becomes, you first need to find what is the highest rank bit that is set here. You go to the corresponding second level bit mask, you find the highest rank bit that is set here, and then you go ahead and access the queue. It's much faster in practice than it is to tell it. Okay. Now, if you have EDF, however, there is no way, I mean, because you may want to have at least 16 bits for encoding the priority levels, so you cannot use this. So this is the meaning, actually, when you say implementation of EDF context switches have overhead, meaning that you cannot use constant time access data structures like this, and you need to find another way. Simple linked list, heaps, balanced trees, whatever you want, okay? Which are typically log n complexity. And if you don't have too many tasks, quite often a simple linked list will do the job. And this is also, I mean, if you find something, you find everywhere, I mean, from an evaluation, you find something like, in the test, we measure the time it takes to release a binary semaphore and schedule a higher priority thread. Same. You release a semaphore, you pick one task descriptor from the semaphore queue, you put into the ready queue, and then you reschedule. You see if in the ready queue there is a task with the highest priority than the currently executing one. So you typically need to access queues, and you say here that in this case the time is constant, meaning that you have an option for releasing a semaphore that is extracting from a semaphore queue is constant time. There is centrality node dependency, and the number of threads pending on the semaphore ramps up from 1 to 255. The time to release the semaphore and schedule the thread remains constant. So getting a task out of the semaphore queue is constant time. However, adding to the semaphore queue, the how long it takes for a thread to acquire a semaphore that is not available, I mean that now you need to take the task descriptor and add into the semaphore queue, right? So now inserting into a queue is here the time it takes for the thread to the semaphore's queue and sorted is proportional to the number of threads already in the queue. So this is a queue implementation as a simple linked list. And these are the measurements that we provide in that report. Okay? So now you can link all these concepts to what is the actual implementation of a ready queue. Okay, second problem. You get, of course, a problem of encoding. How do you encode absolute deadlines into, say, for example, 16 bits that you have available into the task descriptor? Well, actually, it turns out that you don't need to encode all the possible deadlines. The only thing that you need to encode is the concept whether a deadline of a task instance that is active at some time is larger or smaller than another deadline. So we don't need to encode absolute deadlines, but we need to preserve the ordering of the absolute deadlines. We need an encoding that preserves the ordering, right? We don't need absolute values. We only need to figure out which one is higher priority than another one, right? And so you can have, basically, you can reason using clock arithmetics. You take what is the largest possible deadline in your system, and you define a clock which is greater than twice the largest possible relative deadline in the system. Okay? So if your relative relative deadline in your system is, say, for example, 1 second, or say less than 1 second, so we make it simpler, then we need a time structure that is cyclic with a period of 2 seconds. Now we encode this 2 seconds, for example, into a 16-bit field, and we use clock arithmetics. Every time we overflow, we keep going. So, for example, time t prime and t prime plus 2k, where 2 is in seconds, so all times are in seconds. These 2 times are encoded exactly in the same way. Okay? So now with 16 bits, which is around 65k, we can get a decent resolution. Because now 1 bit here is 2 seconds divided by 65,000. Okay? So now we can get down to 30 microsecond resolution here, which is fairly good. Okay? Even with 16 bits. How can we compare 2 deadlines that are encoded in this way? Suppose you have 2 deadline encodings, D1 and D2, at some given time. And suppose, again, you have a 16-bit counter like this. If you have D1 and D2, they are like this. D1 is 43F2 and D2 is 2148. Which one is larger than the other? The difference between any two absolute deadlines is always less than 8,000, because that is the largest relative deadline in the system. So you cannot have a difference that is larger than 8,000 here. Okay? So you look at this and you know right away that D1 is larger than D2 in this case. Okay? However, if you have this other case in which D1 is A01F and D2 is 1013, now D1 is not larger than D2. It's actually the other way around. D2 is larger than D1. Okay? How can you provide an implementation for this? Well, you simply take the difference using absolute arithmetics, and then you evaluate the result using 2 complement arithmetic. Okay? So in this case, the result is 2288, which is greater than 0. In this case, it's 9000900C. The first bit is at 1, so this is the encoding in 2 complement of a negative number. And indeed, this means that D1 is smaller than D2. So this is how you can compare deadlines. So these 2 additional problems now are fixed. You know how to encode everything in 16 bits, because you don't need to encode an arbitrary large time, but you only need to encode twice the maximum relative deadline, which gives you a fairly good resolution. And you know how to compare deadlines using clock arithmetics. Here. Okay? So the only problem that is left is that you actually cannot have queues with constant access time. Okay. Well, despite this, you don't see implementations of EDF, partly probably because not everybody is aware of those results. I don't know. And the second reason, which I believe is the strongest one, is that in many cases, the systems that you actually build consist of tasks with harmonic periods. Task periods are not made from, I don't know, from scratch. I mean, they are coming from control design, for example. So in lots of time, it makes a lot of sense for this period to be harmonic. And when you have harmonic periods, the utilization bound of rate monotonic is 100%. So why worry? Okay. In the few cases in which task periods can be are not harmonic and can bring the utilization bound down, well, you may consider something like this. I'll skip what happens in overload conditions. Basically, in overload, airless deadline is typically worse than rate monotonic. However, it is not true. You may find a statement like, in rate monotonic, if tasks start missing deadlines, it's always the lowest priority tasks that start missing deadlines first. This is not true. It's quite easy to find an example in which it's not the lowest priority task that will miss the deadline. Okay, so the only certainty in rate monotonic is that the highest priority task will be the last one to miss deadline. Okay, so there is only protection for the highest priority one. And you can find a case basically by building on our well-known example, periods 2 and 3. And we know if this is 1 and this is 1, as soon as this is a little bit longer than 1 unit, it will miss the deadline. However, you can build lower priority tasks with long periods that can use the idle time that eventually is going to be found here. So you can build an example in which these tasks are going to compute within the deadline, and this one will miss it. However, in most cases, it is in practice true that lowest priority tasks are the ones that miss the deadline. Okay, now next part. Synchronization and resource sharing. Yes?
A question about the overload condition. I've always been wondering why people care about the overloading condition.
Oh, because you may want to control. Well, in some cases, say for example, you don't have. Well, we said before, it's very difficult to estimate the worst case execution time. So, first, in most cases, people build systems without doing any time analysis or schedulability analysis at all. Okay? 99% of the cases. When they do, still the worst case execution times are not fully known, so you still have a degree of uncertainty. So when you test your system, you may find the case, or you may find yourself in a case in which your system may experience time overheads, overloads, and tasks miss deadlines. As a matter of fact, we worked with systems that are implementing fuel injection in cars. In those systems, utilization is up to more than 90%, and tasks miss deadlines. If a control task misses a deadline, it's not too bad. Okay, we write in papers if a control task misses a deadline, it's a bad thing. That's not true. Okay. Control task may miss a deadline, may even skip a cycle, and in most cases the system will still be fine. The problem starts to happen when a task misses 3 cycles, one next to the other. Then it's a problem. This is why they want to control who's skipping the deadlines. So they know that somebody is going to skip the deadline. Their systems are heavily loaded. So they cannot control everything at testing time. They don't have a development flow that is so analytical and controlled that they prove schedulability. They don't. So they accept overload and they try to control it. And so if your scheduling policy gives you a way of getting additional information on the overload, you can use the priority assignment to control what is going to happen in overload conditions. So this is why it is important in many systems. Okay, when there are shared resources, so you are blocking some semaphores. First thing you may recall from operating systems class, that semaphores may lead to deadlocks. So, in general, if you use semaphores in the most general way, there is no time prediction that you can make, because the system may be deadlocked and response times may go to infinite. However, even in the very simple case in which tasks never behave in a hold and lock pattern. One of the conditions for deadlock is that a task is holding a resource and trying to lock another one. So you need to have nested locks. Even if you don't have nested locks, means that every time a task needs to lock something, locks all the resources it needs at once and releases all of them at once when it finishes. Even with this behavior, it is very difficult to control the worst-case blocking and worst-case response time and to keep using the time analysis we've used until now. As a matter of fact, it's very simple, for example, to show how the utilization bound makes no sense in this case. So you can build a system that is an arbitrarily low utilization and it's not schedulable when using shared resources. So there is no way to use the utilization bound. Okay? I'll probably leave this as an exercise or example. Yeah, it's not in the slides, so I can use it. Now, let's see what happens instead with the response time, which is more interesting. We've seen that that is the tool that we should use in most cases, response time analysis. So what happens with response time analysis, assuming we are using semaphores? Well, now response time analysis becomes a little bit more complicated. Before, we only had the execution time, the time we were spending executing the thread. We had scheduling interference, time spent executing higher priority tasks. And we can also account for highest priority activities like interrupt handlers or non-schedulable or better tasks that cannot be preempted altogether. Okay, so a typical case here again is interrupt handlers. Now we also have this additional time, which is blocking time, the time that you spend while waiting for a resource that is locked by somebody else with a lower priority. You also need to account for this. Okay. Let's see how we can deal with it and what are scenarios that can happen. Let's keep the animation here. I'll try to go for it. So problem here is, suppose that we have a high priority task that is sharing a resource with the low priority task. And this resource is S1 here. So a possible timeline is that the low priority task executes, locks the resource, enters a critical section, and then the high priority task is activated here. Starts executing and then tries to lock the same resource. Now this resource is taken, so it will block here. And control will return to this task, which continues execution inside the critical section. While it is executing, we can then have a medium priority task that is now preempting the low priority task and executing here. While this medium priority task is executing, the highest priority task may be activated and charge its own execution time. Then control will return to medium priority task and so on. And only when this task finishes, control returns to the low priority task, which can complete the critical section, release the semaphore, so now the high priority task can run. Now, the blocking time of this task is this one here. And it's not only the execution of the low priority task that is sharing a resource with it. We're not only delayed by those critical sections. We're also delayed by all the intermediate tasks that may be executed in between here. Okay, this is the meaning of unbounded. It's actually not unbounded, okay? But in the worst case, can be very large, and it is very difficult to compute it and control it. We actually may want to avoid these things to happen. This execution here is actually delaying a higher priority task, right? So we're executing a medium priority task while a high priority task is waiting. And this may be undesirable, okay? So we may want this to avoid something like this to happen, okay? So the next improvement, it's somewhat popular. Oh, okay, these are the methods that we can use. The first one is brutal, and it's non-preemptible critical section. As soon as you enter in a critical section, you disable preemption. Or, alternatively, you go to the highest priority level in the system. It is brutal. It may be better than other methods. And it's simple. Okay? Second method goes under the name of priority inheritance. And this is what you intuitively may have thought by looking at the previous slide. We'll go back to this. The third method is probably the smartest one. It goes under the name of priority ceiling. And as a matter of fact, you find it implemented in real-time operating systems, often under a variant that is called immediate priority ceiling or highest locker. For example, you find an implementation of this into the real-time operating system standard for automotive systems, which is called OSEC, and also the next variant, which is called AutoZar. Let's see what are these protocols. Well, non-preemptible critical section is very simple, okay? It's predictable, prevents deadlocks. At disadvantages, it may block even the highest priority tasks, okay, that maybe have nothing to do with the resource. So in the previous timeline, also the highest priority task will be blocked, okay? So there may be a penalty on all the other tasks in the system. How bad is this blocking penalty? Well, any task in the system may be blocked for an amount of time that is equal to the largest critical section of a lower priority task. Now, good thing is you're going to be blocked only once using this method, and the largest possible blocking is equal to the largest time to execute a critical section from a lower priority task. Okay? Let's skip this. This is also interesting. I don't know if we will have the time to go back to it later on. How to deal with non-preemption altogether. But you see that non-preemptible critical sections are already a way of modeling non-preemptible tasks. So if you assume a critical section of the task is its entire running time, there you can fit the model without preemption within the same framework. Okay. Now, priority inheritance. This probably is mostly useful for teaching and for historical reasons. That's actually the protocol that saved the Mars Pathfinder a few years ago. The Mars Pathfinder got into a timing fault problem that was more or less matching the scenario I've shown before. A high priority task was blocked while trying to lock a resource that was already taken by a low priority task. And medium priority tasks were coming in between and further delaying the high priority task until it missed the deadline. Okay? So this is the scenario that happened in the Mars Pathfinder. How does the priority inheritance protocol block? This is the initial part of the scenario. TLO executes locks the critical section, then T high tau high arrives, preempts tau low, starts executing. As soon as the high priority task tries to lock the resource, it is blocked. But now, when control returns to this low priority task, this guy is inheriting the priority of the high priority task. And it makes sense. Because since this task is delayed by this one, we want this to get through as soon as possible. Okay, it is executing, stealing time to this guy here. So it makes sense for it to inherit the priority of the tau high task that it's blocked. And this is why it is called priority inheritance. Okay? A task that is holding a resource always executes with the priority that is the maximum between its own priority and the highest priority among the tasks that are locked into on the same resource. So this will inherit the high priority of tau high. So now, this is the execution timeline. The tau medium that are activated here will not get a chance to execute. Okay? Because now this guy has inherited the high priority and will not be preempted by those. Okay? This is how you solve the problem of this additional delay from medium priority tasks. Okay? Now, the problem now that we are adding, however, is that if the low priority task is inheriting the priority of the lowest, is inheriting the priority of the high priority task that is blocked on the same resource, this medium priority task will be delayed. So now this medium priority task gets an additional delay because a lower priority task temporarily inherited the higher priority level. And this blocking is not because of a resource that this task is sharing with anybody. Okay? So this type of blocking, it actually takes a different name, and it's called push-through blocking or priority inversion. So now this guy waits for a lower priority task, even though it's not using any resource. And we need to account for this. So this is why when they switched on priority inheritance on the Mars Pathfinder, which by the way fixed the timing problem, before they switched it on, they had to test it on they have a clone of the system on the Earth, where whenever they send a probe outside. So they have a copy that's pretty much the same as the probe. So they tested activation of the priority inheritance on all the semaphores in the system on the copy of the probe they had on Earth. When they realized that it wasn't damaging the medium priority tasks, they activated in such a way that this task could benefit from it. Now, there is an additional problem with priority inheritance, though. And that with priority inheritance, a task can still block multiple times. And this is an example of a scenario that may happen. So you have four tasks from low to high, and they are acquiring four resources in this order. So lowest priority four is getting resource four, then the next priority level task tau three is preempting, executing, getting resource 3, and so on, until the top here. Then we get to the highest priority task. This one first tries to get our 4. It's locked, so it blocks. This guy will inherit the highest priority level, will execute, get out of the way. Control may go back to tau 1 that executes inside resource 4. Then executes a little bit more, and then it blocks on resource 3. and so on. So now you can have multiple blockings of a high priority task on shared resources. And correspondingly, you can have multiple push-through blockings for medium priority tasks. This is the main problem with this mechanism. Plus, we are not going to talk about it. It's not so easy to implement. Think at the what is implied here. What is implied here is that whenever a task locks resources that are nested. Take, for example, a low priority task. It is locking R1, then it's locking R2. And then again, it's releasing R2, and it is releasing R1. So let's say that this task goes through here until this point. Okay? And then it is preempted by some higher priority task. This higher priority task eventually will possibly be blocked while trying to lock one of those. And possibly when it is preempted, another higher priority task will be executed. So in the end, you will have a set of higher priority tasks that are blocked here, and another set that are blocked here. This can possibly happen, right? So now when this guy gets back into execution, it will inherit the highest priority of the tasks that are blocked on R2, right? But it is also holding R1. So it needs to inherit the highest priority among the tasks that are holding this one or this one, right? And this until here. When it releases R2, now the inheritance rule changes, and it will need to inherit only the highest priority among those ones here. So you need to keep a stack of inherited priority levels, and you need to manage those queues at the semaphores with all the tasks that are currently being locked on those semaphores. Okay? So this is something that typically we would like to avoid. And in the general case, again, if you're using this mechanism with a pattern like this, hold and lock, you may still have deadlock here. So worst case blocking time when using priority inheritance can only be controlled when you don't have a pattern of hold and lock. Okay? But all the tasks get the resources they need in one single shot, and they release again when they're finished altogether. I'm not going to talk about the formula for computing the worst case blocking time here. I'm going right away to the next mechanism. The next mechanism is a little bit apparently more complicated. However, the implementation is quite simple. So the next mechanism goes under the name of priority ceiling. Priority ceiling requires to compute some values offline statically. You need to assign to each resource in the system a priority value that is called ceiling. And the ceiling of a resource is the highest priority level among all the tasks that can possibly request the resource. So this is why it's static. You analyze the code of the task, you see which task can possibly try a lock on a resource, and that task contributes to the ceiling level of the resource. Okay? So each resource has a ceiling priority level. And then you also need to maintain this one at runtime. Another value which is called the system ceiling. The system ceiling is the highest ceiling among all the resources that are locked at any given time. Okay? So whenever you get a successful lock on a resource, you see if that the ceiling of that resource is higher than the system ceiling, and if so, you update the system ceiling. Okay? So again, now you need let's say, a stack of values to maintain the system ceiling. And at this point, the rule for this protocol is simple. A process can only lock a resource. Well, first, tasks or processes still behave according to the priority inheritance rule. So whenever they lock a resource, they inherit the priority of the highest priority among all the tasks that are blocked on that resource. Okay? And second, the process can only lock a resource if it's dynamic priority, meaning its base priority or the priority it is currently inheriting, is higher than the system ceiling. So now the rule for locking a resource is very simple. Okay? There is a variant of this protocol that is even simpler. And it says whenever a task enters, locks a resource, it will not inherit the priority of the highest priority of any task that is blocked on that resource. Whenever a task enters into, is executing in a critical section on a resource, it will immediately inherit the ceiling priority. Okay? So now the priority inheritance mechanism becomes very simple. Does not depend on who is locked at some given time. As soon as you get a resource, you get your priority raised to the ceiling priority of the resource. That's it. Okay? And again, the rule for getting a resource is still the same. You get a resource only if your priority is higher than the system ceiling priority. It turns out you don't even need to manage the system ceiling priority in this case. Turns out in this case, tasks that may possibly block on a resource do never start, actually are kept in the ready queue. And when a task starts, it is guaranteed to get all the resources it needs. Okay? So this is why implementation of this protocol is very simple. You don't need to maintain the system ceiling. The only thing you need to do is whenever a task gets a resource, it inherits the priority ceiling level of the resource. That's it. The good thing is, there are many good things with this protocol. It avoids deadlocks. It can be demonstrated that there will never be a circular wait. Whatever is the pattern of request of the resources, you are never going to enter into deadlock. So this is the same case as before when immediate priority ceiling had multiple blockings. Okay, so we have four tasks, R4 and tau 4, 3, 2, 1, and those are trying to get these resources in this order. Only what happens now is, and this is how tasks are trying to access resources. So tau 1 is actually trying to use all the resources, 2, 3, and 4. And so the ceiling of all the resources is 1, the highest priority among all the tasks that can possibly use the resource. So now as soon as task 4 enters resource R4, its priority is raised to the highest priority level, to priority level 1. This means that task 3 and 2, even if they are activated, they are not even starting. They are kept in the ready queue. When 1 executes, possibly delayed by this critical section, it will execute until the end. It is guaranteed that it will never be blocked. Okay? Now, there are two other things that we may want to notice here. One is that, of course, we still have push-through blocking, because we still have priority inheritance. The other thing is that this protocol also guarantees that the execution of the tasks is perfectly nested, or if you prefer, never interleaved. So you're never going to have an execution pattern where you execute 4, then 1, then 1 blocks, and control returns to 4, and then 4 exits from the critical section and control returns to 1. Okay? If a task is preempted, whoever is preempting will execute until the end before control returns to the task that's been preempted. And this allows an execution model that goes under the name of one shot and allows the tasks to share a single stack. I'll go back to this in a second. So, now, what is the formula becomes this one. For now, the response time is the execution time of a task, interference from higher priority tasks. And now we have a new term here, which is worst case blocking. If you use priority ceiling, the worst case blocking is easy to compute. You may be blocked at most once for the duration of a critical section. Which critical sections should you use? Oh yeah, here, priority ceiling and immediate priority ceiling. You're blocked at most once on a critical section. Which ones should you consider in this maximum? Which are the critical sections on which you can block? You can block on a critical section executed by a lower priority task that is sharing a resource with you. That is clear, as in this case. Tau 1 is blocked on a critical section that it is sharing with a lower priority task. So the longest critical section that is used by tau 4 and share with tau 1, that gets into that maximum, needs to be considered for the worst case blocking time. Okay? But you can also have push through blocking. So you also need to consider all those resources that are shared by a task with higher priority and a task with lower priority than yours. So also those ones need to be considered here. So the maximum critical section that is executed on a resource shared between the task for which we are doing this computation and a lower priority task. And also the maximum among all the critical sections that a lower priority task is sharing with a task with a higher priority than the task we are considering. Okay? Now, there is a very simple table-based method to compute this worst-case blocking. Assume we have 5 tasks here that are using, can possibly use 3 resources, R1, R2, and R3. The times of the critical sections are here in the rows. Okay? So tau 5 can spend 10 units of time when using R1 and can spend up to 3 units of time when using R2. Right? This is the meaning of this table. How do we do compute the blocking? Whatever we need to consider, well, first thing that we do, we draw lines like this. From the lowest, for each resource, we draw a vertical line that goes from the highest priority task that is using the resource to the lowest priority task that has a critical section on the same resource. Okay? Without including this last value. Okay? So we go by columns, we see what is the first entry, and we draw a line that includes the first entry down to the last one, only we don't consider the last one. Okay? And then whenever we need to consider a task, we draw a horizontal line, and we see what are the red lines, the vertical lines, that get an intersection. Those are the resources that need to be considered. So for tau 1, we need to consider resource R2. Now we go down and we see what is the maximum value here, which is 5. So in this case, the blocking time for tau 1 is actually 5. This column here. For tau 2 is actually has intersections on all 3 resources. So now we need to consider the maximum value among all those that are down here. Well, for priority inheritance, you may have realized it's the sum. For priority seeding, it's simply the maximum among all these values. So the maximum here is 10. So 10 is the worst case blocking time. And for tau 3, it is again 10, which is the maximum, still intersecting all the three lines, and 10 is the maximum value. Tau 4, the same, we got an intersection with this and this, and the maximum value down here is 10. And by the way, for these two guys, this 10 is a value of a possible push-through blocking. Task tau 3 is not using resource 1. So it may be blocked by this critical section when 5 uses it and it's bumped up to priority level 2. This is where this task can get 10 blocking, 10 units of blocking time. So this is a very simple method for computing blocking times. Of course, the lowest priority task always doesn't have any blocking time. Okay, and this, there are a few examples, scheduling with offsets, we can skip this. Okay, I guess we can skip altogether this thing here. Yes?
So the priority seeding protocol doesn't really work with dynamic
priorities. There is a variant of priority seeding that also works with dynamic priorities, with EDF. And it is the same, the ceiling, I don't remember anymore the details, but I can tell you there is, goes under the name of Stack Resource Policy, or SRP. I can point you to the paper. And it has the very same properties here. So you may be blocked only once, and if you're blocked, you're blocked while you are in the ready queue. So you never start executing and then get blocked while executing, okay? Oh, one thing that I wanted to point out, and then I'm going to steal some more minutes here. There are two things that I wanted to discuss. The first is one additional benefit of immediate priority seeding is, as we have seen before, that task executions are never interleaved. Let's go to the meaning of this. You have a system, multi-program system with several tasks. You can have different models for an implementation of this system with respect to the implementation of the stack space of these tasks. So you may have some memory, RAM memory, that is reserved for the stack space of those tasks somewhere. So now each task has its own individual stack. Okay? Now, RAM memory is a problem in single chip systems. There isn't much RAM memory. If you see basically as the data sheets, you will find that you typically have 20 or 30 more times ROM memory than RAM memory. And you know the reason better than I do, because you are more into hardware design than I am. RAM memory is much more, takes much more space. So you typically don't have so much RAM memory, and you want to save as much as possible when you're having a single chip implementation. So let's go to the stack space. Managing the stack space is basically the only way in which an operating system can control the allocation of RAM memory. The other ways are all compiler dependent. Doesn't have a lot to do with the operating system. So let's say first model, each task has its own stack space. If you don't have any additional knowledge on the scheduler or the scheduling, what is the worst case need of RAM memory for the stack spaces of all the tasks? You need to add up the maximum stack requirements of all the tasks, right? Which can be pretty bad in some cases. Now suppose you have another model, the one that is enabled by protocols like immediate priority seeing. If you are certain that the execution pattern of tasks is always interleaved, meaning that whenever a task is preempted, whoever preempted it will execute until the end before releasing, before returning to the task that's been preempted. So this is the execution pattern as opposed to something like this. Okay, this is interleaved. Okay, if you have an execution like this, you cannot share the stack space. Because now we have one, so you have the stack frame of one here, then you get two, and then you need to go back to one, but only one cannot grow its stack here, because now this needs to be saved, because two needs to restore the execution. Okay? So in this case, you are forced to have a model like this, where each task has its own stack space. However, if you have a model like the other one, then you can share stack space. Because you first get one, then you get two that is executing, and then the stack is taken by three, which is using the stack space. When three finishes, you need to have a model that is called one shot. At the termination of a task, the task releases completely the stack frame. So now control can go back to two, and then back to one. Okay? So now you may tell me, well, yeah, this is easier to manage than having separate stack spaces, because now you get only one, but the worst case requirement is the same as before, right? In the worst case, you don't know the point at which you are preempting, so this may be the maximum, and then the maximum, right? Now suppose on top of this, you add an additional mechanism, you control preemption among task pairs or task groups. And you say, for example, 2 and 3 will never preempt each other. We put them in a group and we state a rule that the tasks in this group do not preempt each other. Now this means that in this stack, you're either going to have the frame of 2 or the frame of 3, but never both of them at the same time, because they don't preempt each other. So now you can trade preemptability for stack space, which in single chip applications may be a reasonable thing to do. Okay? If you don't have preemptability, you have an additional blocking term in the response time formula. You can check the response time formula and see if everything is still okay. However, if you don't have preemption, you can reduce the stack requirements, because now you know that the requirements in terms of stack from all the tasks that do not preempt each other do not need to be added up to compute the overall system stack requirements. But you only need to take the maximum stack requirement from any task in a non-preemptible group. Okay, this is the first thing. Second thing, and I promise will not be more than 5 minutes. I need to go back to the first set of slides. This problem here. You want to provide an implementation of a flow preservation communication mechanism in the one-to-many communication case. We have seen in the first lesson Simulink has the rate transition block mechanism. Okay, so that's a baseline mechanism you can always use. However, you can do better than that. You can save some buffer memory whenever you have a one-to-many communication. So, now, let's go to the problem. We have a one-to-many communication among blocks at different rates. Let's assume for now that all these blocks are periodic. periodically activated. They are periodic activation events. Okay. So how many buffers you need here to store the information that's going from the sender to the receiver? Okay. Well, there are two ways of sizing these buffers. One is that at any point in time, you only need, well, this is a little bit more complex. You may have a communication pattern like this. Writer, readers, multiple readers. Some of those readers may be connected with a link on which there is a unity link. So in this case you need a number of buffer positions which is equal to n plus 2, where n is the number of readers. And this is always true in the worst case, because each reader instance will use at most one of those entries. Plus one entry is needed to store the value with the unit delay, and one entry is needed by the writer to update the next value. So this is one way of sizing the communication buffer in a one-to-many communication. Okay? Even this one may not be the most efficient one. Now compare this again with the rate transition block mechanism, in which you need at least two buffers on each link. This is already better. Okay. Now the other possibility, you can use time analysis to bound the number of buffers that are needed. And basically the idea is to have a pattern that is kind of like catch me if you can. So suppose writer and readers are activated according to a periodic time base. Let's also assume that each writer and reader will terminate before it is activated again. So deadlines are equal to the periods. Okay? So we need to set up an array of communication buffers that works like this. The writer is always, whenever it is activated, the writer keeps an index into this array of buffers. Whenever it is activated, it will use the buffer position with the next index. Okay, and so on. And the buffer is a cyclic buffer. So it's very easy to manage. Okay, so you are in the entry with index I, next activation it will use I plus 1, and so on. Okay. What must be the size? How many entries do we need in this buffer? Well, let's see what is the condition. When we use entry I here, let's assume the writer is activated here and it is assigned the entry with index I. Right after this point in time, readers can be activated and so can get a reference to the same entry. Okay? The reader that is activated here will read this value from the writer. So a reader now can possibly hold the position here. The writer will now use items I plus 1, I plus 2. Eventually, it will roll back in this array, start using item 0, 1, I minus 1. And at some point here, it will use again item I. Okay? So the condition now is that whatever reader got a reference to the entry with index I between this point in time and this point in time, must have finished executing before here. So all readers that got this entry reference, by this time must be guaranteed to have finished execution. If this is true, then we can reuse entry I. No reader is using it anymore. Okay? So this is based on the concept of lifetime. So we call this as the lifetime of a data entry. Right? And we can use time analysis on the readers to compute what is the worst case lifetime of a data entry. And if we know the period of the writer, then by dividing this lifetime by the period of the writer, we know how many entries we need. Okay? And this is expressed there. So you may have a bound on this offset between the writer and the instance of the reader that is activated after this instance of the writer, and then you have the worst case response time of the reader. By this time we know that the reader finished using the data value. Okay? So the lifetime is this maximum offset plus the worst case response time of the reader. This is the lifetime for a given reader. If you take the maximum lifetimes among all the readers that are using the same values from the writer, then you can use this maximum lifetime to compute the number of entries you need. So actually this is the way you compute it. You take the lifetime for a given reader, you divide it by the period of the writer, you take the ceiling, and this is the number of buffers you need. So this is the second method for sizing the buffer. One is based on the number of readers that can possibly use the values, and the other is based on the concept of lifetime, the fact that after some given point in time, nobody will use that value anymore. Okay? The interesting thing is that you can combine the two methods to actually find an implementation which is better than each one of them taken separately. So you can have a buffer sizing method that is better than the two of them by combining them. This is really all I'm going to say for now. Again, if you want to know details about any one of those things, please come back. I can give you references to papers or books or whatever it's needed to understand those things better.